Veterans Radio is dedicated to all the men and women who have served or are currently serving in the armed forces of the United States of America.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Thronberry.
And good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. This is another one of our special programs with our new host here on Veterans Radio, which is Dwight Zimmerman. And Dwight is on the phone talking to us live from Brooklyn, New York. Good morning, Dwight.
Good morning, Dale. Glad to be here.
Well, it's going to be your program today, so kind of give us a little profile of what's coming up after our first break.
I will be happy to. I'm really happy with our guest today, Craig Simons. He's a distinguished historian. He wrote a thrilling account of a pivotal battle in World War II, the Battle of Midway. And we have New York Times best-selling author Larry Bond, who's going to be talking about his exciting new book, Exit Plan, which you would swear was torn from today's headlines because it involves Navy SEALs, Iran, and nuclear weapons program.
Well, it's really exciting. I can't wait to hear both of those interviews, Dwight. But I'll talk a little bit about an event that occurred yesterday in New York City, and that was the arrival of the Space Shuttle Enterprise.
Yes, that was very exciting for the whole city. Today's papers are splashed with coverage all over the place on it. And, well, of course, it was obviously a big topic in the television broadcasts last night. It was quite exciting. We had people, lined up. They did a flyover of the Statue of Liberty, so the people on Liberty Island had a ringside seat to the event. The aircraft landed at JFK Airport, and a barge will take the space shuttle up to the Hudson River, where it will be at its new home.
Is it going to be on the Intrepid?
On the Intrepid, thank you, yes.
Okay, that's all right. I'm still anxious to go and see the Intrepid. I've been told I have to go and see this.
Yes, you do. I have been there a couple of times. First time was shortly after we had mementos from the Iraq War, and they had a wonderful display there. They've got an incredible array of aircraft and helicopters. It's wonderful. And then they did this massive restoration and reconstruction, and it is something. You can get into flight simulators, play games, a wide range of interactive displays. They've really done a great job.
Well, I encourage all of our listeners to go and look for information on the USS Intrepid. It's in New York Harbor. And also, there are some great pictures online about the Space Shuttle Enterprise as it arrives in New York. It's a fascinating story, and I'm hoping that the space program will continue on to bigger and better things, because it certainly was a great program and really showed what we could do here as a country once we get behind something.
You got that right.
I know I do. We're going to be taking our first break right now, and when we come back, Dwight will be hosting today. And so I'll be quiet after that, and we'll be right back after these messages. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
Well, we're back at At Ease, the program that we talk about military-themed stories, and I am happy to welcome my first guest today, Craig Simons. Craig, how are you?
I'm great. Good morning, Dwight.
Yes, great to have you on the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Okay, so the Battle of Midway. This is obviously a very important battle, and your book is just absolutely riveting. But the fascinating thing is that, you're one of our nation's most respected authorities on the Civil War. You shared the Lincoln Prize in 2009 with James McPherson. Your book was Lincoln and His Admirals. And now you jump into the next century and do a book about a pivotal naval battle in World War II. What prompted this?
Well, that's other people have commented upon that. You're absolutely right. I have been doing research on the Civil War for nearly four decades, and to jump into World War II does seem perhaps like I'm jumping a century, but I will remind you and our listeners, too, that I did teach naval history to midshipmen at the Naval Academy for almost four decades, and we certainly covered the Battle of Midway there. In addition to which, I have to be honest and tell you that my editor at Oxford University Press, which published both books, after the Lincoln book came out and was so well received, asked me what I wanted to do next, and I said I would like to at least think about a project in which I examined Franklin Roosevelt as the commander-in-chief in World War II in the same way I examined Lincoln as commander-in-chief in the Civil War. And they said, well, that's a terrific idea, but we would also like you to do a book in our series called Pivotal Moments in American History. And clearly one of those pivotal moments was the Battle of Midway. Well, I initially said, well, I'm not sure that's needed. I mean, there are good books on the Battle of Midway already. Walter Lord wrote a classic book on the Battle of Midway, and Gordon Prang, only a decade or two after that, wrote another great book, so you sure there's room for one more? Well, of course, my editor knows exactly how to get to me. He flattered me, said, ah, yes, but not written by you. So I ended up writing yet another book on the Battle of Midway. Man, enjoyed very much doing it, and I think found some new things.
Yes, you're right. Walter Lord's incredible victory book on the battle has been a benchmark. How is your book different from his and the earlier other counts?
Well, one of the advantages I had was the declassification of materials that were still secret at the time that Walter Lord wrote. Walter Lord was not only a great historian, but a great wordsmith as well. In fact, I suppose the greatest compliment to him is that if you visit the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., and I hope everyone who's listening has an opportunity to do that, you will notice that on the Pacific Theater side of that impressive memorial is a couple of sentences from Walter Lord's book carved into marble in letters 6 inches high. Now, there's no greater testimonial to an historian than to have that happen, so it's true. But look at the title of Walter Lord's book, Incredible Victory, and then look at the title of Gordon Prang's book, Miracle at Midway. Both of these books talk about the astonishing turnaround in that critical 5 minutes from 10:25 till 10:30 in the morning on June 4, 1942, when the whole history, not only of the Pacific War, but the history of the world, tilted on the fulcrum of the Battle of Midway. And it seemed so providential, so miraculous, that they attributed that to a large extent to circumstance and opportunity. And I tried to look at what individuals, what personalities, what human beings, and the decisions that they made and the actions that they took brought about that miracle, that providential turnaround. So I'm looking at the people. That's one, perhaps not entirely new, but somewhat different approach that I took in my book. And then, as I mentioned, there's new information that's available, information that wasn't available to Walter Lord or to Gordon Prang, some of it provided by two superb scholars who looked at the Japanese side of the battle, Anthony Tolley and John Parshall, who in their book Shattered Sword, great title, by the way, looked at the Japanese side, at what was their motivation, how did this come about, what were the personalities of those individuals. So I tried to bring all of these things together and tell the story I hope, a fresh way to expose not only what happened, but who did it and why they did it.
Well, why did the Japanese go after Midway in the first place?
Well, that's interesting. You know, Midway was officially the target of the operation, but it wasn't really the objective, and I'll explain what I mean by that. Midway was a tiny little two-island atoll, 1,100 miles north-northwest of Honolulu, and really just an outpost for America. As a target, it's not that important a place. It does have an airfield on it, so it's a useful outpost for the United States. But the reason the Japanese went after it was that Yamamoto, who had planned the attack on Pearl Harbor, was excruciatingly disappointed not to have found and destroyed the American aircraft carriers in that strike on December 7th, 1941. And since then, in January and in February, the United States had used those carriers to target Japanese outposts in the Marshalls and the Gilberts and elsewhere. So what Yamamoto wanted to do was to attack an American base, in this case Midway, with a large enough force that the American carriers would feel compelled to come out from their base at Pearl Harbor into deep water, and the Japanese carriers could then pounce on them and destroy them. The real objective in this campaign was to find and destroy the American aircraft carriers. That's what it was all about.
How did the Americans learn about this?
Well, that's a great part of the story, absolutely. And Walter Lord knew a little of this, but not very much because it was still classified. Gordon Prang knew more of it. But there's been a lot of information that's come out just in the last couple of decades, really declassified only in the 1970s, that the United States had broken a significant portion of what's called the five-number code, the Japanese operational code. Now, we've been reading their diplomatic code for a couple of months, but the operational code was extraordinarily complicated, and we didn't really crack the code there until early spring of 1942. And the guy who gets most of the credit for this is a Navy commander named Rochefort, Joseph Rochefort, who commanded a team of dedicated crypt analysts, code breakers, if you would, in the basement of the 11th Naval District headquarters in Honolulu, a dark dungeon, they called it, where they spent the entire day and sometimes 20-hour days or more breaking through all the layers of secrecy that wrapped themselves around all the Japanese naval radio messages that came out, and were able to winkle out just enough information from that to let Admiral Chester Nimitz know that the Japanese did intend to target Midway, more or less when they were coming, and more or less what strength they would be coming in. And so that advantage significantly helped even the odds. It was not, let me emphasize, it was not a complete reading of the Japanese naval messages. That the extent to which we have been able to break their code has been somewhat exaggerated in popular literature. We could not read their mail. We got little bits and tiny pieces, 10% of 10% of the messages that they sent. So we were able to read maybe one out of 100 words. But from that, Rochefort was able to apply his understanding of Japanese culture, Japanese language, and Japanese tradition to let Admiral Nimitz know what he was pretty sure was going to happen. And that gave Nimitz sufficient confidence to resist the Japanese attack at Midway.
Yes, that was one of the many fascinating aspects in your book, The Battle of Midway, that you went into great detail and depth about how Rochefort and his team cracked the code and assembled it, and in some cases inferred and speculated on actions and, in one respect, made calculated guesses.
Yes, that's true. There were a lot of blanks. If you look at a typical message that was supposedly broken, it might say something like, blank, blank, Kaga, blank, blank, depart, blank, blank, May, blank, blank, arrive. And from that, Rochefort and his team had to put that in the context of all the other messages, where they were coming from, how many there were, where they were going, who was sending, who was not sending. In a few cases, they even were able to recognize what was known as the fist, that is the characteristic tempo of a telegrapher's signal, to know who was actually sending the message, and being aware where that particular sender was stationed, they could then extrapolate what the message might mean. So there was a lot of, I hesitate to call it guesswork, but I suppose there's no better word for it. I would say informed guesswork that Rochefort and his team applied to what they were able to break. So it was not simply a matter of breaking the code and reading the mail. There was a lot of intensive, hard work involved.
Yes, there was a breakthrough of sorts when Rochefort being challenged about, because there was some controversy of whether or not the Japanese objective was centered around Midway or some other location. So, correct me on this, but didn't a signal go up from Pearl Harbor to Midway, say, send us a message that your water treatment system is broken down?
Yeah, that's true. What had happened is Rochefort and his team knew. They were absolutely certain Midway was the target. They had no doubt in their minds. But the problem was that his superiors in Washington, The Naval Communications Office and the Intelligence Office there, known as OP-20G, and run by a Captain Redmond. He was not so sure. Redmond was not a cryptanalyst. He was an administrator. He looked at this message traffic and said, boy, that really doesn't say much to me. Are you sure? I really think it might be something else. Maybe it's the West Coast. What if it's San Francisco and you're wrong? And so what Rochefort wanted to do was demonstrate, not for his own benefit, because he was pretty sure, but to demonstrate for Captain Redmond's benefit that it was, in fact, Midway. The Japanese had used the code phrase AF in referring to the target of their attack. And what he wanted needed was information that proved AF was Midway. So you're right. They sent a request out by submarine cable, where the Japanese could not read it, to Midway saying, let's send us a radio message in the clear saying that your distillers have broken down and you are running low on fresh water. And then he waited. And sure enough, hours later, a Japanese message went out saying, AF is short of water. Well, now he had the smoking gun. Now he could demonstrate to the doubters in Washington that AF was indeed Midway, and that he was justified in predicting that that was the Japanese target.
Now, ironically, Rochefort, instead of getting praise and a medal for his role in what wound up being an American victory, actually wound up being punished for his efforts, though not by Nimitz. What can you tell us about this?
Well, punished is a strong word, but I suppose not an inappropriate one. Rochefort, like many brilliant people, was a difficult personality. He was annoyed that people would not believe him when he gave his predictions. He believed that the folks in Washington had no business looking over his shoulder. So he brought a little of this upon himself by his attitude. But it is absolutely true that the OP-20G, his supervisors in Washington, found him annoying, shared that annoyance with the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Ernest J. King. And when Nimitz recommended Rochefort for a medal and a promotion as a result of the extraordinary work that he had done at getting the United States Navy ready for the Battle of Midway, King turned it down. He said, no, this was a work done by a team of men. You don't give a medal for people just doing their job, which is an absurd statement to make. We do it all the time if they do their job extraordinarily well, which surely Rochefort did. And worse than that, then, Rochefort was reassigned from intelligence work into construction work. He was actually sent to the San Francisco Bay Area to construct a floating dry dock, which he did quite well. He supervised the construction of that. And when the war came to an end, he was actually back in intelligence working on the plans for the invasion of mainland Japan, which, thank God, we never had to do. But you're right, he never got the medal he deserved while he was alive, although there is a happy ending of sorts to the story, and that is in 1986, he was awarded the Distinguished Service Medal posthumously by President Reagan. So he did finally get the recognition, the public recognition, that he deserved and had earned, but not during his lifetime.
Well, at least there was that. One part about the battle itself that really stood out for me is the fact that the senior commanders on both sides, Nagumo, Fletcher, and Spruance, well, they were black shoe admirals in command of carrier fleets.
This came about by accident. You know, it was not supposed to be that way. For those of our listeners who aren't aware, although I suppose most of you probably are, the warfare communities within the Navy were not completely distinct from one another, but they did have special skill sets. And those who were pilots who had earned their gold wings were known as brown shoes, and that is to say they knew not only how to fly, but what were the particular needs of air squadrons and air groups, and they were the ones who were assigned to command carriers. And the most senior of these was Admiral, Vice Admiral then, William F. Halsey. But Halsey had come down with horrible skin disease that absolutely necessitated his going into the hospital virtually on the eve of the greatest carrier battle in world history at Midway. And although he recognized the necessity for it, it must have been horribly painful, both mentally and physically, to have to turn that command over to someone else. And when Nimitz asked him, well, who can we give this to? He said, well, my subordinate, Raymond Spillins, who commands my screen, knows all of my officers, has been operating with me for most of a year. He's the man I trust to do this. So Raymond Spillins, who was a cruiser destroyer man, commanded Task Force 17 of two carriers, and Frank Jack Fletcher, who had commanded in the Battle of the Coral Sea and was also a cruiser destroyer man, commanded Task Force 16 and was the senior American officer present at Midway. So the Americans were commanded by two ship drivers, as we call them in the service, that is to say surface warfare officers, with very little carrier experience. At least Frank Jack Fletcher had commanded a carrier force in the Coral Sea, but Raymond Spillins, of course, had no experience in that at all. So the Americans were being led by individuals with technically little experience in commanding carriers in battle.
And Nagumo was a big gun admiral himself, but wound
Nagumo Chuichi, who commanded what the Japanese called the Kido Butai, or the Mobile Striking Force, the in this case four carrier task force, he had experience at least with carriers. Remember, Nagumo had commanded the strike on Pearl Harbor when he had six carriers. So he had not only commanded the strike on Pearl Harbor, he had then commanded the Japanese carrier force in the Indian Ocean and elsewhere. So for 6 months and more, he had been in command of a fast carrier strike force. So he had that experience. But his training, as you say, was in torpedoes. He was a torpedo man. So the Japanese, on the other hand, didn't have quite the same division between warfare specialties that the Americans did. So Nagumo was probably, at least in terms of experience, better prepared for the Battle of Midway than his American counterparts. Although, as things turned out, that didn't matter.
Yes. Well, he seemed very rigid, and also, oddly enough, reports say he wasn't much of a gambler.
Well, Nagumo was a professional who played by the rules, who knew what the protocol and the doctrine was and tried to follow that protocol and doctrine. It's very hard to second-guess Nagumo. We can do it after the fact now because he lost, and given the disparity of forces, he ought to have won. But if you find the moments where he makes specific decisions and think about now what would have been the right decision to make at that moment, it's hard to say at any given moment he makes the wrong decision. But clearly, after the fact, we can look at it and say that did not work out for him. The classic case is on the morning of June 4th, when he first hears from one of his scout planes that there are American surface forces 200 miles away, and about a half hour later learns that at least one of those is an aircraft carrier. Well, now the carriers are his primary target objective. That's what he's after. So one thing he could have done was launch right away. The problem was he only had 36 airplanes ready to go out of nearly 300 that he had totally available, 285, 290, the numbers are not entirely clear. But if he launches only 36 airplanes, they would have no fighter cover, they would have no cooperation from torpedo bombers, so he said, no, that's not a good idea, I'm going to wait, I'm going to recover the airplanes coming back from the attack on Midway, rearm and refuel those airplanes, and then send off an entire coordinated strike force, and that will be better. It sure seemed so at the time, but of course, even as he made that decision, the American dive bombers were en route to his position.
We're almost coming up to the break, but one thing I would like to briefly talk about is, even though accounts focus primarily on the Japanese mistakes, the Americans made a few also.
Oh, a number of mistakes. We look at this event and want to look back and say, you know, we did everything right. Luck was on our side. Providence was on our side, however you want to measure that. But there were lots of mistakes made. There are mistakes in every battle, I suppose. But they really stand out here because Admiral Nimitz had gone to great extent to make sure he had three aircraft carriers available for this battle. The Yorktown was patched up and put together with baling wire and scotch tape, metaphorically at least, and sent out to the operation so that we would have three carriers, but one of those carriers played virtually no role whatsoever in the battles on the morning of June 4th, and that was the USS Hornet. And the story of the USS Hornet and its air group is a very complicated, perplexing, difficult, absolutely amazing story that I probably can't summarize in the brief time we have on the air, but I hope your readers will have the opportunity to read it in my book. How's that for a plug?
Yeah, that's anticipating what I would say, that I've been talking with Craig Simons, the author of this excellent book, The Battle of Midway, which is it coming out in paperback soon? It's out in hardcover right now.
It probably will not be out in paperback until late fall, I would say October, November. It is in hardback right now, obviously available on Amazon or at your local Barnes & Noble or other favorite bookstore.
Yes, and anyone who is interested in a gripping battle well told, it would be very well served in getting this book. That is for darn sure. Craig, you're at a conference this morning, from what I understand.
In fact, I was going to mention to you and to your listeners, I am standing at the ferry dock on Hatteras Inlet in North Carolina, where the weather is cold and breezy, and cars are lining up to get on the ferry boat. As soon as we finish talking, I'm heading off to a conference on Flags Over Hatteras, which is about the Civil War battles at sea in the vicinity here of North Carolina. So I'm having a great time. But always good to talk to you, Dwight. I appreciate it.
Yes, and it's a wonderful talking with you, too, Craig. I really enjoy this. I'm also going to congratulate you. I saw that Military History Quarterly selected the Battle of Midway as a best book of 2011. Wonderful honor.
That's terrific. Very gratifying. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'll let you get on that ferry boat right now. And, Craig, thank you so much. And I hope that what's your next book, by the way?
Well, I'm going to be working on that book I mentioned to my editor when we first decided I should do Midway, and that is something about Franklin Roosevelt as Commander-in-Chief in World War II.
Oh, great, great. I'm looking forward to that. So take care. Thank you again, and good luck.
Thank you, Dwight. Enjoyed our conversation. Bye.
Yes, bye. So, again, that's The Battle of Midway by Craig L. Simons. It's published by Oxford University Press. Craig is an absolutely wonderful writer. I've had the delight in working with him in the past. He is a fantastic individual, and yes, you would be very well served in picking up this book and also his book, Lincoln and His Admirals, which in 2009 was a co-winner of the Lincoln Prize. So this is a wonderful thing. Dale, how are we doing here?
We're doing just fine, Dwight. We're getting ready to take a break in about 10 seconds, and we'll be back with Dwight Zimmerman and his next guest, Larry Bond, right after the Medal of Honor. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
Intense enemy fire had pinned down leading elements of his company, committed to secure commanding ground. When Burke left the command post to rally and urged the men to follow him toward three bunkers, impeding the advance. Dashing to an exposed vantage position, he threw several grenades at the bunkers. Then returning for an M1 rifle and adapter, he made a lone assault, wiping out the position and killing the crew. Closing on the center bunker, he lobbed grenades through the opening and with his pistol killed three of its occupants attempting to surround him. Ordering his men forward, he charged the third emplacement, catching several grenades in midair and hurling them back at the enemy. Inspired by his display of valor, his men stormed forward, overran the hostile position, but were again pinned down by increased fire. Securing a light machine gun and three boxes of ammunition, Burke dashed through the impact area to an open knoll, set up his gun, and poured a crippling fire into the ranks of the enemy, killing approximately 75. Although wounded, he ordered more ammunition, reloading, and destroying two mortar emplacements and a machine gun position with his accurate fire. Cradling the weapon in his arms, he then led his men forward, killing some 25 more of the retreating enemy and securing the objective. Burke's heroic action and daring exploits inspired his small force of 35 troops.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
This is Dwight Zimmerman at Ease on Veterans Radio Network. Welcome. And I am happy to welcome our next guest here, Larry Bond, the New York Times bestselling author, who is going to be talking about his new book that comes out next month on May 18th. It's called Exit Plan, and it is one exciting story, that's for sure. Larry, welcome.
Dwight, hi. Thanks for having me.
So I'm happy that you're here. So tell us a little bit about this book. How did you arrange to have Iran and the SEALs and the United States set this whole thing up so that your story can come out?
Right, you're breaking up just a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. We got a little technical difficulty here. But the phrase, torn from today's headlines, tends to be overused, but as it turns out, this story, you'd swear that you were right there in the Situation Room.
Well, it's supposed to give you that impression. We try for that, Dwight. But it was this situation between Israel and Iran has been going on for years. It's the kind of thing that really plays to a writer's advantage because it's there's great tension, there's tremendous forces involved, there's a lot at stake, but things are moving very, very slowly, diplomatically. And nobody's shooting at each other, which is a good thing, but things are moving slowly. Therefore, I've got time to write a book, get it edited, and get it on the street before, and, you know, hopefully nobody will shoot at each other before that happens. And my job as a writer is to look at that situation, knock the props out in the first chapter, and then see what happens naturally after that.
Okay. Exit Plan is the third in a series of Jerry Mitchell books. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Well, Jerry Mitchell is the name of the hero, of course, and he's a aviator who was a little bit of background about him. He had a crash early in his training and lost use of one of his full range of motion in his hand, so to speak. So he can't fly anymore. He wants to stay in the Navy, and he goes into some nuclear submarines. He's actually based on a real world character that I knew. He didn't go into the fellow that I knew was on surface ships like I was. And I said, what if you wanted to go into submarines? And that was sort of what the first book was about, Dangerous Ground. It was about him getting into submarines and then, you know, finding out about what life was like aboard them. And then think Hornblower after that. In the next book, he's now a department head, higher rank, more responsibility. He's aboard a different ship, a different boat, as the submariners say. And then in this book, he's now advanced in rank again. He's the executive officer aboard an Ohio-class SSGN, USS Michigan.
Yes. Okay, the story of Exit Plan basically is he's part of, he joins with a SEAL team to extract two Iranian nationals who are involved in the Iran's nuclear weapons program. And, of course, you know, things start going bad very quickly. And one thing after another, it turns into this incredibly fast-paced, gripping story. I have to tell you, when I got your book in the in the mail, it was both it was like great, and then I said, oh, I know what's going to happen to me now, and I couldn't put the book down. I really couldn't. It was just so hard. You wrote such a compelling story, and just when you figured out which way the story was going to go, you threw in a surprise here. You threw in another surprise there. You had a lot of twists and turns in this tale. I was hoping that things would turn out right in the end, but it turned out in a way that was completely unexpected for me. And I've been in the industry as an editor and a writer for over 30 years, and you surprised me a lot here.
Well, thank you. That's high praise. My principal job as a writer is to deprive people of a good night's sleep. And
you did that.
I think Well, that's the highest praise I can get, that somebody couldn't put it down, that they were totally immersed and engrossed in the story. I mean, everybody calls me a writer. I think of myself as a storyteller. I mean, I tell a story, and I happen to write it down, so I don't have to tell it multiple times. But when I can immerse you in the story and make you ask questions about how are they going to get out of this, that's really what every writer wants to do. And as you know, I should surprise you on almost every page, because otherwise, if you know what's going to happen next, then why are you reading the story? You're reading the story to find out because you don't know.
Exactly. Well, you were a co-founder, instrumental in creating this whole techno thriller genre, and I have to admire your ability of when you're talking about the different weapon systems and the gear and the hardware, you give us just enough so that we feel that we know what this stuff is, how it functions, and everything, without going too far. And you have a deft ability to know when to back off, especially when we're getting to the climax.
I've tried to build that skill. The gear, the nuclear submarines, the jet fighters, the satellites, that stuff is there for the same reason they have horses in a Western. It's there for the heroes and the other characters to do their job. And some of it's fun to talk about. And I've seen writers who get so wrapped up in the muzzle velocity of an M16 rifle or the exact way you trigger a Claymore mine, and a lot of numbers makes people's eyes glaze over because it's hard to hold those facts in your head. Is it important what the muzzle velocity of an M16 rifle is? If it's important, put it in there, spend a little time on it, then drive on. But to just throw in numbers to show how much you know, I don't think it accomplishes anything.
Yes, and the other aspect, some authors in the techno-thriller genre, their characters are two-dimensional, cardboard. Not yours. You flesh them out very well. This is talking about exit plan. Your characters are living people. You really care about them. I would like you to talk about the two Iranians specifically, because it is such a touching and poignant story. These two people really struggled with the decision to betray their country. So please tell our listeners more about them.
Well, I've got an interesting relationship with the Iranian people in that while I was going through officer candidate school, we had an Iranian company in our regiment. These were guys that the Shah sent over, during the 1970s, and they were being trained to use U.S. equipment. And not only we were Juliet Company, and right across the passageway from us, Romeo Company, yeah, I know, it was a joke, and they were the Iranians, and these guys were sharp. They were all, of course, they all spoke flawless English, and they were good guys. I often imagine what happened to them when they went back, and then there's the revolution, and how many of them made it through that, and that's another story. They were also the first six women in the Iranian Navy were in my regiment, and these gals were all beautiful, barrier breakers, of course, and they were paid as E-1s, even though they were commissioned as officers. And you couldn't ask one for a date. You had to ask all six out. So you had to get six guys together and go down there, and they'd all run around and check with each other. Then they'd go up and ask the men. And once it was okay with the men, then those six women would go out with you as a group. And I learned a lot about the Iranian people and the Iranian culture from my exposure with those folks. And so I don't see them as the rifle waving jihadist nuts that sometimes gets portrayed on the news. I see them as people with a long history and a very complex and cultured civilization. I think their government needs to be totally flushed and replaced, but that's neither here nor there. So when I went to write about those people, I said here's a couple who. Young couple that are very much in love with each other, and it's easy to show that. And at the same time, they're repelled by their government and what they're doing. So it was. I tried to imagine that type of thing, and a lot of the reactions were almost automatic. I mean, okay, the the lady is the stronger of the two because she's the one who made the initial decision that we're leaving. Her husband is faithful. He has his own reasons for leaving, and he goes along with that. And some of the stuff, I mean, given that high type of strong woman, who I think a lot of us have had exposure to, I was able to almost, it was almost easy to come up with what her reactions would be to different situations when there is a problem with the initial extraction. And they're stranded, you know, Jerry and his SEALs are stranded on the beach along with two people he's supposed to, they're supposed to rescue. And is that a classic, you call this a rescue reaction or what? I mean, it was almost too easy to write that scene. But yeah, I really thought of them as people and as central to the story as Jerry and his SEALs.
Well, on top of that, you had her be pregnant, and so on top of everything else, then you add multiple layers, which is basically what I'm trying to get at here for our listeners. Larry's stories are not just straight, action adventure, though there certainly is an awful lot of that. When you open up a Larry Bond book, it's an incredible journey. You are pulled in so many different ways emotionally. I've just been in awe of how you pull these things together. Now, you have a website that people can go to find out about your other books as well, correct?
That's true. There's a larry-bond.com, and I'm on Facebook, and I try and I update the Facebook more than I update the larry.bond because I can update the Facebook myself, of course. But I try and keep people...
Okay, well, Larry, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we have to take a little break right now. This is Dwight Zimmerman talking to best-selling author Larry Bond. We'll take a break and be right back. This is Dwight Zimmerman of At Ease from Veterans Radio Network, and I have as my guest Larry Bond, and we've been talking about his upcoming book, Exit Plan. Larry, I'd like to talk about a pivotal group within this story, the Navy SEALs. I've had the good fortune of meeting a number of SEALs, interviewing them, and writing accounts of their some of their missions, and I was impressed at how well you nailed down how they operate, their personalities, how they at every level of them pulling off a mission. You did an awful lot of research on this.
We did, and part of that was one of the things we wanted to do in this book was take Jerry Mitchell, who's in the past two books we've shown to be a very capable and resourceful submariner, and put him in a situation where he's a little outside his comfort zone. In other words, he's not on a submarine. All of a sudden, he's on land and involved in a very personal struggle to stay alive. And this is not something that most naval officers are trained for. And the SEALs that he's with are very... I was in the Navy in the 70s, and I trained Surface Warfare Officer School for me. It was at Coronado, California, which is where the SEALs trained. And so we would see these guys during Hell Week running around carrying logs and inflatable boats, and we basically thought they were insane. We were glad they were on our side because their entire regimen seemed to consist of physical exercise and learning how to kill things. So that's the attitude of a lot of fleet towards these guys. They're sort of a projectile. We fire at different targets as needed. And they're incredibly capable guys. So I'm gonna plug somebody else's book. If you're looking to learn about the SEALs, Dick Couch has what I call the SEAL Trilogy. Dick is a SEAL who served in Vietnam, and he's an amazingly good writer. And he wrote a series called Warrior Elite, Finishing School, and then Downrange. And those three books take you through Bud School, which is an amazingly detailed account of not only the Hell Week, but what's in front of them behind that. And then Warrior Elite, which is the year plus of training they get after they finish their SEAL training. And then Downrange actually puts them on some missions. my co-author, Chris Carlson, had the good fortune to work for a SEAL, as a former SEAL, a retired SEAL, as a civilian. And so we talked to him. His name was Ryan McCombie. He was also a Vietnam SEAL. And Ryan, of course, knew college because all SEALs know all other SEALs. And Ryan told us so much about SEAL attitudes, SEAL training, SEAL practices, which are not, it's funny, a lot of it doesn't have to do with combat or with some sort of special techniques. It's more a matter of thorough preparation and planning and training to a degree that most of us would regard as almost pathological. But this is what keeps them alive, and it works.
Okay. And they had enough challenges tossed their way during their escape and evasion efforts. The Iranian head of security, a shadowy character that he is really he's a marvelous villain. I would not like to meet this man.
I had a lot of fun writing him.
Tell the listeners more about him.
Well, it's every good story needs a good bad guy, and unfortunately, the security services in Iran, as they are right now, are legendary for their ruthlessness and their viciousness. And so, coming up with a character based on someone who was also almost taken directly from the newspapers wasn't that hard. I tried to put some motivation in him so that the people. I hate it when the entire motivation of the villain consists of him getting up in the morning and saying, I think I'll do evil today. Everybody does things because they think they've got good reasons to do it. And he's got his own reasons, screwy as they are. And from his point of view, the book is almost a detective story as he tries to track down these intruders and bring them to what he thinks is justice. His personality lends itself to that, I think. And, of course, he gets his comeuppance in the end, which, we got to do that. It's one of the rules. I had a lot of fun writing him. I have as much fun writing the villains as I do writing the heroes because at some level you have to be able to identify with the villain as a writer and say, okay, what is he going to do next? Yeah, this makes sense for him. So you've got to have some sort of rapport with your characters.
Yes, the way that he is taken care of is a quite spectacular finish to the story. I have to commend you on that one. You have another book in this series coming out. You're almost done writing that, is that correct?
Well, yeah, the fourth Jerry Mitchell book, and I obviously don't want to talk too much about the plot. Although it's given the natural progression, yes, in this book he's going to be the captain of a submarine now. He's advanced through the years and through different adventures, and I've got a June 1st deadline to turn that in, and then I will go through the publishing editing process with Poor Forge Books. Hopefully, it will come out sometime in 2013. It's amazing how long it takes to get a book from the shelves or on the shelves from the manuscript form, and a lot of it has to do with the what they call the buyer's cycle, which lasts. Well, you know more about that than I do, but for the readers, it's like a 6-month cycle, and if you miss one part of that cycle, you have to wait another 6 months to catch the merry-go-round next time it passes, and. It can be a little frustrating sometimes. It's been very frustrating with Edgar Plan. We delivered the manuscript, and all of a sudden, the news is full of things about SEALs. It was just about a year ago that Osama bin Laden was killed, so SEALs were all of a sudden a very topical subject. And we'd already turned in the manuscript, and I said to my editor, "We got to get this thing on the street. This is hot stuff." And He said he'd move heaven and earth to try and get it out as quick as he could. And he managed to shift the publication date from late June to late April. 2 months. That's all he could give me. And then it slipped. So now it's coming out in mid-May.
Yes, you're participating in a charity event on the May 18th pub date. Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, it just happens. One of my good friends down in North Carolina said, you know, let me organize some sort of publication party. And, you know, authors being people love to have parties. And if our book's involved and people are talking about our books, this is a good thing. And so her name's Kathy Fell. And for anybody who's down who can get to Sunset Beach, North Carolina, which is a beautiful little community, they're going to have a charity event which supports a charity called Cattails. And it's a cat adoption service, and it's a worthy cause, in my opinion. We have a couple of rescued cats ourselves. And the idea is Forge, on their, just out of the goodness of their heart, are going to donate books, new copies of the book, and people can buy them. The money will go to Cattails. And then, of course, I'll be down there with my co-author, Chris Carlson. We'll both be autographing copies of the book. And we'll have the rest of our backlist there, too, if anybody wants to buy the other stuff. You know, we don't want to miss up any buying opportunities there.
No, sir. So I've been talking with Larry Bond
Saturday,
here.
Which I guess is,
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say it's going to be on the Saturday, which I think is May 19th, technically. I haven't looked at the calendar lately. I have to double check that. But we're going to do a couple of events down in that area.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Larry Bond about his new book, Exit Plan, which is an exciting action techno thriller adventure that will be out next month, May 19th, and I hope that everyone has an opportunity to check out this book. Certainly, you can go to his website, larry-bond.com, and find out about more about Larry and his many books. He's an exciting writer, a wonderful, wonderful author of many books, and just very thrilled that you've been a part of our program today.
Well, it's been a lot of fun being here.
Okay. So, Dale, I guess we're nearing the end of our show. Larry, I just want to thank you so much for being on the program, and I hope that to have you on here again when we're going to talk about the fourth book in your series. Can you tell us that title? Or is that still top secret?
I'm sorry. It's just like, can't do it.
Okay.
Thanks so much. Thank you for your many kind words.
Oh, and thank you for being such a great storyteller. Yeah. And a warning to everybody, if you do pick up a Larry Bond book, do it in the morning and make sure that you're doing it on a weekend or where you're not going to be going to work the next day, because it's going to be very hard, if not impossible, to put down.
Thanks very much. Have a good day, Dwight.
Thank you. You too. So.
I am here.
Hi, there you are, Dale.
I am here. Thanks again. It's a great program. And we've got another one coming up next week. We're going to be talking with Owen West, excuse me. That's Bing West's son, who has written his own novel called Snake Eaters, about his experiences in Iraq in 2005. And so we're excited to have him on the program. Dwight will be back next month with another story, and we got about 10 seconds to say thank you, Dwight, again, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Yes, thank you, Dale, and thank you to everyone who is listening today.
You are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or the station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.